Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue, along with our esteemed panel on this Wednesday, the 24th of April. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning,
yo,
Alan.
Yo.
He's texting. Please give him a break.
Yeah, give him a break.
He'll step up to the mic in a
texting
moment.
Texting while broadcasting against the law.
That's right. It should be.
Ray Graff is with us.
Hi.
Good morning. And our the part of our panel that makes it just so esteemed is Stephen Gottlieb, the James Kaplan Distinguished Professor at Albany Law School. Good morning, all, and good morning, Stephen. Thank you very much for
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a delight to have you here. So give us a sense. We've been talking a lot this week about issues and why we wanted you to come in, because we've been talking a lot about issues having to do surrounding the Boston bombing case, a lot of different things that have come up within within the law. And yesterday, our poll question, what we were asking listeners to weigh in on, was the death penalty. And what I wanted to talk to you about and invite you in to sort of give us a sense of what it is we're talking about when we talk about the death penalty, why that is not universal in the sense of what it means in New York is not what it means in California, is not what it means in Texas, but also ultimately how we get there through the law.
And go.
I'm trying to digest that question. Let me.
Do you want me to parse it?
No. let me back up. The thing that has been most striking to me about the death penalty has been the pendulum. That is that when we have a death penalty, there are tomes written about the number of people who were executed, and then it's discovered they were innocent. So we eliminate it in one way or another. And then when we don't have death penalty, then it becomes commonly assumed that if we had a death penalty, crime would go away, although crime was rampant when we did too. And it's never been possible to prove what difference the death penalty would actually make. I was struck also years ago we had a little panel at the law school that was comparing canon law, the law of the church, Catholic Church, with ancient Hebraic law. And the rabbi that was part of that little discussion commented that if the Sanhedrin, the court, was unanimous, they could not execute. It had to be non-unanimous so that they were convinced they'd heard everything, which I thought was a very interesting commentary on the death penalty, going back many thousands of years. But the death penalty, in some sense, goes back way beyond that.
Well, I was struck by the conversation that we had in the morning and that Alan had in the afternoon was how much religion became a part of that discussion when people would call up and say about their personal opinions about the death penalty, said that I am against it on moral and religious grounds.
Absolutely. And the death penalty has been declining around the world, and certainly in the democratic, relatively civilized part of the world, it's been declining, and except obviously in the United States as a whole. Although even here, I attended a farewell reception for David Kaczynski, who has been the executive director of New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty.
Right.
And he'd done that for some years. I mean, we all know, of course, his brother was the Unabomber, and it was David and his wife Linda that figured that out and told the authorities that. David's done a wonderful job, and of course, as a as someone very involved with the Civil Liberties Union and president of the local chapter for some of those years, we stood with David at many events trying to get rid of the death penalty. And we've had success in New York. We've had success in some neighboring states. And I think David and his organization were part of that. And a good deal of that conviction certainly was religious in its orientation.
I brought up the question about the states earlier, and New York, I think, is an interesting example, because when Governor Pataki came in, he made it a mission to have the death penalty instated in New York.
And in fact, Joe, I just want to add a little insight into that, is that it's one of the ways he beat Mario Cuomo issue.
This is what I'm going to do. It was later taken down in the courts, but Even then, it wasn't something that it seemed that the courts within the state embraced.
I think that's right. And in fact, one of the lawyers arguing against the death penalty was former New York Court of Appeals Judge Hancock, who spoke very eloquently against the death penalty and made those arguments to his former colleagues when
now, if you
he
listen,
retired.
I'm sorry, but if you listen to Vox Pop yesterday, if you listen to the calls we got here yesterday morning, you would think there was nobody for the death penalty, basically. You just got through, Joe, quite correctly saying that one of the ways that George Pataki beat Mario Cuomo was on the basis, you know, of the death penalty. And Mario always carried that around on his back because he was a man of principle who just didn't believe in it. So there's a sort of a distinction between those people who believe in it. Perhaps they watch Fox and don't listen to WAMC, but there does seem to be an awful lot of people who are for the death penalty.
Oh, yeah.
Which, bringing up the question, I mean, is it a red state, blue state issue?
You're asking the political science question. I want to duck that one.
The answer is yes, but no. I mean, we're talking about New York State and Mario Cuomo. So that there really may be a majority of people who just go about their business, but think if their kid is killed, they want somebody punished for it with the death penalty and the rest of it. And then there may be people who went to college and took sociology. So, I mean, I really think there may be that difference.
And I think part of what you were getting at with the way you started the discussion was that all the states are different with respect to what crimes are death eligible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So New York historically, even when it's had the death penalty, at least in recent years, has had a fairly small group of crimes that are death eligible, whereas in some states that list is much larger. So there was a period when New York had death eligible crimes where you were already in prison and you killed someone.
Or killing a cop.
Or killing a cop, exactly. And so most crimes in New York were not death eligible. But in other states, it could be for any murder of any sort. There's a spectrum in that
sure,
sense.
But you know what? If you ask somebody whose five-year-old daughter has just been raped by the neighbor, which just happened in India, whether the capital punishment should be imposed on that person and they tried to strangle her and, you know, all the rest of it, that person is going to say yes. I'm sorry. There were people who called yesterday and I posed that question to them, which I tried to do. One woman took great offense to the fact that I asked her the question. But it really is fundamental.
I've had that nightmare.
Way in which we approach this.
I mean, our firstborn child is my daughter.
Yeah.
And I've had all sorts of nightmares about things that could happen to her. And at least in my dreams, I've pulled the trigger.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I was thinking about something, Joe, and that is we have a phrase, death by cop. We don't have a death penalty, but in some situations, and you watched it happen online as Osama bin Laden got taken out, I don't think he was threatening anybody. I don't think anybody, he was threatening anybody that day. I think that the issue was that they didn't want to go through martyrdom and trial for him. And so out he went.
Mm-hmm.
And you raise another issue, which is that the whole drone program bypasses all the protections of the Bill of Rights and some protections that were in the original Constitution before the Bill of Rights.
And now, Professor, somebody would say to you that there's a difference. I'm not one of them, by the way. But just for the sake of argument, that the Constitution protects you, the people of this country, not the people of, I mean, the big debate was, would you use a drone in the United States to do this kind of work? And the answer to that seems to be no, because of what you've been suggesting.
Well, the answer to that certainly should be no because of what I'm suggesting. But you talked about death by cop, and that's one of the real tragedies, that you're having an individual officer who, for whatever reason, is short-circuiting the entire process. Of determining whether we have somebody who's actually guilty of whatever we think that they have done. The Constitution and those provisions are not limited to citizens, so anybody that was on trial in an American court would get the same protections.
Sure, but not in Pakistan.
It's actually quite controversial about the extent to which the Constitution has extraterritorial reach, but presidents are not likely to be advocates of the theory that it is. Although one could imagine that it would be very beneficial to our foreign policy if we acted on the assumption that it were.
And if there's an American citizen who happens to be in that building when the drone comes over.
Exactly.
Stephen Gottlieb is the J. N. Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor at Albany Law School and is part of our panel this morning. Alan Chartok is here, as is Ray Graff. We welcome your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Quick break. We'll be right back to continue the conversation before a news break at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to our discussion roundtable at WAMC.org if you would like to weigh in. And of course, we invite you to and hope that you do. Alan Chartok is here, Ray Graff is here, and Stephen Gottlieb, the J. N. Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor at Albany Law School. I think it's so cool that you have a title that includes the word distinguished.
Well, I think the good part is the J. N. Ruth Kaplan part.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll soon put a stop to the distinguished part. In the next 35 minutes, that should be crossed off.
Once he puts this on his resume,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
add this to the CV and take that right away.
Right. His name.
Yeah. I do. We're going to go to a news break in just a few minutes, but as we wrap up a little bit on the issue of the death penalty, obviously, an event like this, an issue like this, that happened a week and a day ago, and a lot has happened. But I assume, given your work and given your work in trying to curb the death penalty, that an event like this is at least good for debate and discussion about it. It gets people thinking.
But it's probably a setback because there's so much anger.
Yeah.
And in some places, that'll play out differently because the patterns are stronger. There've been, so many Supreme Court decisions where even this conservative Supreme Court has overturned decisions from certain states, like Texas, for example. It's very clear that there's some states that really want to do it and are kind of thirsting for it and don't rein their officers in different ways.
We have a state senator around here who's calling for a ball, who's calling for torture.
Yeah.
And I believe is an opportunist, and therefore one has to then extrapolate that to mean that he thinks there are enough people out there who are for torture and the death penalty that he's doing it because it will lead to an electoral victory for him. Joe McCarthy did exactly the same thing.
Right. It has nothing to do with what advantage we actually get in the system. Torture. I was, by the way, horrified by a decision that I was reviewing actually last night, in which the what we call the plurality opinion. He didn't actually speak for a majority. He spoke for four members of the court. Decided that torture was not a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. Or I should say, not a violation of the self-incrimination clause of the Fifth Amendment. And Souter led a group of justices that decided to send the case back to see if it was a violation of the Due Process Clause. But that was a rather stunning decision that he came up with a few years ago. But again, and, you know, Joe and I have both taught interviewing. I taught it while the roundtable was going on, so we never connected in class. You don't get information out of people by torture or by scaring the heck out of them. You get information out of people because they don't know you're giving it. They're giving it to you. And because you make them comfortable enough that they lower their guard.
So if that's true that it doesn't work, how come we do it so much?
It does produce confessions, but a large percentage of those confessions are false.
I believe that.
You can't trust what you get because what happens, and you know, there are records of people who actually do the torturing, not only here but in other countries. And they'll say to you, people will tell you anything they think you want to hear. But if you then test what you get by whether you've heard anything you didn't know and didn't tell them, the answer is almost never.
So if there's, I hate to quote the esteemed academic font, Law and Order, but if you have a child who has been kidnapped,
right,
and a 4-year-old who's been kidnapped, and the detective, they're not looking for a lot; they just want to know, where's the kid?
Right.
And is he alive?
Yeah, and right, or she, and puts the guy's head in the toilet until they tell. Then we're not talking about lying, because you still have a toilet and you still have the detective. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're gonna ponder that. We're gonna take a moment and take a break. We're gonna go to our NPR news, and we'll be back and continue the conversation. Stephen Gottlieb is here, Ray Graff, Alan Chartok, and we welcome you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable. On our panel this morning, we have quite a group before us. Stephen Gottlieb, the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor at Albany Law School, joins us. Alan Chartok is here, as is Ray Graff. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We have been talking for the first half hour of our discussion mostly about the death penalty. I want to talk about another issue that has come out of what happened in Boston. And again, it's hard to believe that it's, you know, a week and 2 days ago that, you know, all this has happened in over our 8 days or so. But the other big issue is that gets us thinking and gets us talking is surveillance and privacy. There was an opinion, a editorial that was written in the Boston Globe yesterday that said it was cameras on the street that led to the rapid identification of the brothers Tsarnaev. It was cameras on the street that likely stopped them from killing even more. The effective use of surveillance in the Marathon bombing seems to make a compelling case for installing even more cameras in our world. Except the next time around, the terrorists might wear wigs or mustaches and thick-framed glasses, or perhaps they'll do their deeds in the dark. Surveillance cameras seem like a simple solution to crime and terrorism. Technology has advanced so that cost and data storage issues are no longer a big deal. The cameras are easy to use and deliver clear, high-quality images. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg predicts that soon there will be cameras everywhere. Boston has quite a few already, including hundreds on subways and buses. So too do many other American cities. The United Kingdom is held out as the most advanced example of their use, with at least 1.85 million surveillance cameras in place. That is one camera for every 34 citizens. And the this editorial goes on, but the next line is where I will stop, which says, yet there is scant evidence they do much to improve public safety. And that's where I would like to start our conversation when we talk about this this balance of surveillance and law enforcement and privacy.
Okay. First of all, just to clarify one legal issue, you're out in public. Our courts say you have no privacy. You're out, you're on the street. Obviously, fighting crime and committing crime is a kind of a constantly changing game. So you raise things that people could do to defeat cameras. We've had, in the past, we had some cameras inside the law school that were destroyed before people did, and I forget what they did or took. It's some years ago. There are too many cameras on the street for somebody to do that, and it would become pretty obvious. And if they walked out on the street with a mask, they wouldn't have been able to blend into the crowd the way that they did. So maybe that changes the crime, but doesn't necessarily make it impossible to commit one, as people pull masks on and go into convenience stores and gas stations and all kinds of situations like that. The NYCLU had an interesting experience in that under the prior executive director, Norman Siegel, we assumed that we should fight against the cameras. That is, the organization made that assumption. And then Norman and other staff people started talking to people in the housing projects and discovered they wanted the cameras.
Oh, sure.
It gave them a feeling of safety. And one of the interesting things is, if it gives people a feeling of safety, that feeling can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then maybe they trust being in certain areas. And once those areas have people in them, they change in what they're like and whether people will commit crimes in those areas or not. There is another side to the cameras, and that is a side to which they really do violate privacy. Jeff Rosen, I forget, a decade or so ago, he writes for the New Republic and, mm-hmm. and teaches at, I think it's George Washington Law School, very fine legal scholar. And he went to England and he studied their cameras. And he found something that we kind of knew anecdotally, which was that the cameras are very often either turned on to situations where they can explore someone's bedroom, or look down somebody's shirt, or that kind of thing, so that the...
You mean these are public cameras doing that stuff?
Yeah, police cameras.
Could be or were?
Were.
Okay.
Were. And we know that also, I mean, anecdotally, we know that in Washington Park in Manhattan. Because
that was recent. Yeah.
Well, you're talking about recent, but some years ago, Norman went and talked to the police there, and they said, "Come on, we'll show you our cameras," and they actually showed him those uses. So, and then of course, there are some cases that I have taught where things of that sort of happened. So there clearly is a use of the cameras.
Wouldn't that be the appropriate thing to do? Is to make that public and make sure that those people who are doing that are fired, for doing that?
Of course.
Because that's just, I mean, is that an argument against cameras, or is that an argument against errant cops who might beat somebody up, for example?
That's
just,
right.
You know, so.
That's right. Anything can be used in multiple
different
ways.
In fact, Joe and I have been talking about this here. Isn't it possible, Steve, that a lot of lives have been saved. A lot of things have been done because somebody has a TV camera on the front of a cruiser. So now, for the first time, if cops are misbehaving, you have proof of it.
You know, I've never been able to go back and find what I read in the 60s. But there was a Bar Association proposal to do something exactly like that, only not with television. It was with audio tape, I think.
Sure.
And it was specifically designed to deal with interrogation at that point. But the most powerful thing that you can do is to get the questioning on tape, audio tape, or even better, videotape. And what you're describing is the cameras on the car. Because then you can see whether, you know, who's doing things right or wrong. And you're also collecting evidence. If the cop is actually going appropriately after somebody, you know, there's evidence that may be useful on the car, on the camera.
I just want to touch on two quick issues in regards to this. And one is your point about public cameras versus those cameras that are in the lobbies of hotels or in the convenience stores is there a fundamental difference there? I understand your point about being on the street and having the government cameras, but then there is also the cameras that are in private buildings, and then that footage becomes available.
Well, can I change the distinction that you're making a little bit? I mean, I think the major...
If by change you mean corrected, yes.
I would never say that. I would distinguish between cameras that are fixed and fixed in public areas, and the lobby of a hotel is a public area. The bedroom of a hotel is not.
Mm. Okay.
All right? So whether it's in a hotel, that's a place of public accommodation is what we literally call that.
So if you go to a mall and they say this is private property and yet they have a camera in that mall, it's still a public place.
That's right. And in fact, one of the things that I think most New Yorkers don't know is that the New York Constitution actually puts obligations on the owners of malls. They are treated as places of public accommodation because you're inviting the general public to come and do business there, and therefore they have various obligations. But that obligation actually goes back in what we call the common law centuries.
So for all of us, and I do, because we had two incidents at our house, who put cameras up, what are our problems? I mean, you know, it's an interesting question. People walking down the street. But we had police problems. Yeah. And it was because of me. My wife was opposed to it. She didn't want to have cameras on the house, as you might think. I thought that, okay, if this kind of thing is going to happen, this is going to be defensive. And in fact, one guy put up on one of the blogs, stay away from his house. And this is a guy who we had problems with. Stay away from his house. He has television cameras on his house.
Good.
Yeah, well, that was my feeling. Yeah.
So it also didn't matter from that perspective whether the television cameras were actually in operation.
No, actually, I thought it did matter because everybody can buy these phony little cameras.
Right.
Yeah, but that's right.
But he may or not have known the difference.
Yeah.
But the point is, knowing this
guy, he knew the difference.
Yeah. Okay. 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 The little light was on.
The second issue I want to get to before we have to go to a break is this editorial in the Boston Globe makes this point, saying most of us would probably acknowledge that law enforcement should be able to use surveillance data in cases of terrorism,
absolutely,
or violent crimes. Mm-hmm. But how about minor incidences such as casual drug use or civil actions such as a divorce suit? Mm. You are not with who you should be with. That is where, you know, should we draw a line? Should that be off limits? And how do you draw that line?
How you draw the line, I don't know. It's not a line in that area that the American courts have been drawing. The line that Dan Solov, who's also, I think, at GW, where Rosen is, has been drawing is these mass databases that show all of your movements, innocent and otherwise. Mm. And the way that you can extrapolate from that, and one of the things that Dan worries about is that you extrapolate falsely on that. You draw inferences that are incorrect.
So, for example?
Oh, he gives so many.
I just need one to help my brain.
You buy a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
Okay. What does that mean? Are you about to commit terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it mean you're starting a family? Does it mean you have a mistress and are giving a pressure cooker to your mistress so she can cook for you?
That's what I give to my mistress, by the way.
Oh,
it's one of the nicest gifts you can give to your mistress.
I'm glad to know that. I guess you're right. That wasn't a good example there, but
let me just twist it and say, yeah. Okay, so you go on to you as a professor, or for we as journalists, go on to Amazon.com and we buy a book or the anarchist cookbook so that we can see try to get a sense in our reporting of how these bombs are created. Then it is put out into the greater world that we purchase this book.
Now
our intentions are to understand the issue more fully. You, in an academic sense, your intention is to understand it more fully. But obviously, you still purchase the book like someone who would purchase that book for nefarious purposes.
And when easy. I was... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's pretty easy for an investigator to determine, you know... Basically, all this information is out there. It's like the Echelon program,
right?
That listens to all the phone calls from the NSA. It basically,
but no matter
filters
what
out all the stuff that doesn't matter.
But no matter what's true, and maybe this is from working with the gentleman to my right for as long as I have. Yeah. But if they want to get you, they'll get you no matter what you're
right.
I'm not quite sure I got the reference to the right to General Turing. Me.
You.
Yeah.
Meaning that
means everyone's out to get you, I think is what he's trying to say.
Whatever your motives are, even if they are true motives, they want them to be perceived as as not good motives, then they can make that case.
Would be the Gottlieb side of seeing it. I mean, that's what a civil libertarian believes.
So, as
many libertarians.
From my point of view, the line should not be about what the data is as the use of the data and the safety and control of the data.
Yeah.
Because for many reasons, you're going to want to collect a lot of data. And that's not necessarily a wrong thing. But then... How do you who's allowed to amass that, and then what do they have to do when they find out that you've done that falsely? You know, the mass aggregations of data are being used to deny people all sorts of things, from loans to houses, or you know,
sure.
and because they make all sorts of assumptions about people. And the problem is you don't even know how that got constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't quash it because that information is all over the place. So there's something about, there needs to be something about the conditions under which data can be used. And I'll give you another example. A policeman, if I have the time, and I don't remember the date on this. It just happens to be a case that I taught. A woman came in and complained about having been injured, and the policeman convinced her to take her clothes off so he could investigate the wounds. And he took pictures, and then he circulated the pictures. And she found out about it when one of her friends told her that he or she had seen these pictures. So, it shouldn't have been that cop taking the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
That there should have been a police matron or a medical individual or somebody like that who was investigating the wounds. Normally, you would take the woman to a health facility
And there would be several people in the...
Yeah.
That's right.
Male or female.
Then, but even if it's done at the right facility, can it get released?
That's B.
And what are the protections against pictures which were maybe, in that, if it was done right, could have been properly taken to preserve evidence, and how they can then be used.
And also, and this is becoming an issue in the Boston case, is that not only are we talking about the pictures that are quote-unquote officially being taken, but since everyone has a camera in their pocket, that they can now, people can take pictures without anybody even knowing that they're taking pictures and circulate those pictures.
And this gets done in locker rooms all the time.
Yeah.
So
And one other thing, and that is that in one of the tabs this morning, and I go through them pretty quickly. It was a story. It seems
I don't envy you that.
No, I don't like to do it. But there's you
yes,
gotta,
you do.
No,
but,
I don't.
But he admits and
you,
it, and that's what's important.
Yeah, and you have to do it because you have to keep up with them, and know what they're up to, especially if it's spelled POST. And there was a story about a woman who had sold to these guys, to the terrorists, the so-called terrorist suspects, black powder as it was packaged in some other thing. And that was enough black powder to use in the pressure cooker. And they had pictures of the whole thing, I believe. Or they took pictures of her. But, you know, that sort of post facto, you know, stuff is helpful evidentiary later on, but can also be somewhat scary. Now this woman's face is across the nation.
There was a story. I didn't see the story in the Post. There was a story.
It may not have been the Post. May have been the other one, NEWS.
I can remember when the Post was a decent paper.
Oh, yes. And the News inspired a folk song called I Read It in the Daily News.
Yes, but when I was in the legal services program, it was easier to break news on behalf of the poor in New York in the Daily News than it was in a certain other very deservedly famous paper.
TIMES.
That one. So we often did that. But I did read about one of the companies that sells explosives for fireworks.
Yes.
And
this may have been it.
Excuse me?
This may indeed have been.
And they, in fact, did sell fireworks to the older brother, Tamerlane.
This may have been the story.
They, when they realized what happened, immediately apparently called, I don't know if it was the FBI or who they called, but they immediately reported that this had happened, although he said that what they had sold him wouldn't have been enough to do the damage that they saw.
But why isn't this newsworthy, Alan? I don't understand.
Who said it's not newsworthy? No, I'm just talking about the idea that you're taking pictures of all of this, and that's helpful.
So as a civil libertarian, you're pretty much saying the genie is out of the bottle. All this information is going to be collected. The real fight is how it's controlled.
Exactly.
I see.
We're going to take a quick break. We will wrap up when we come back. We are talking to Stephen Gottlieb, Alan Chartok, Ray Graff. We welcome your thoughts always. Roundtable, WAMC.org. We'll continue after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue. Alan Chartok is here. Ray Graff and Stephen Gottlieb has been with us, the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor at Albany Law School. Been talking about a lot of heavy issues, obviously. And you know, I asked you this question earlier, and you said it's in terms of the death penalty, it can be a setback. What we've been going through over the last 7 or 8 days. But like any event like this, when people start talking very seriously about legal issues, I assume that's a good thing. I find that just your hesitancy, I find fascinating.
Well, you know, part of it is because even though I've made a career of interpreting certain political science data to the legal profession.
But I'm talking about us as a people, as a culture, as the fact that the general population thinking about these issues.
Oh, I see.
I mean, this is your job, so I understand right. your point. But yeah. but I'm talking about the average Joe, Ray, and Alan who are reading these papers, no matter how they're spelled, thinking about these issues.
You're talking about how the issue is framed.
No, he wants to know, is it good? Is this a good thing?
I understand that. But what you're saying is actually changes the way the issue is understood. It doesn't necessarily sure. give people a fuller understanding of what right. happened. It tends to make us all operate. You know, there isn't a good word for what I want to say, so I want to use a bad word, but try to take the sting out of it.
Okay.
Just don't make us lose our license.
It makes us operate like a mob, in the sense that we're all kind of thinking the same way, and the normal sort of checks and mm-hmm. fullness of the way we think about things don't work. I walked out of the station last Monday. I had just recorded commentary to be done a week ago yesterday when all of this broke.
Yep.
And immediately, it's like, why did I record a commentary on taxes? It's because I just wanted to be part of this conversation, and yet I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. So I didn't come back. But that's just a way of saying it affects us all. In many ways, it affects us in the same way. That's not necessarily a better discussion.
That's a profound issue. The way the whole subject is framed becomes by the media and by you.
It is. It's fascinating stuff. Always great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Still distinguished after the
yes,
hour.
Yes,
well
yeah, absolutely.
Well
see, that's why he's distinguished. Yes.
Okay.
Stephen Gottlieb, Alan Chartok, Ray Graff, thank you very much. We will be back tomorrow for another panel, of course. And coming up next on the program, something really, really interesting.
What?
You're listening to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue.
Whatever.